Three individuals from the department are also here, can answer some questions. Sherry Hill, who's a special assistant in the commissioner's office, Deputy Commissioner Carlene Jackson, and Assistant Commissioner Janet Clark. Madam Chair, a number of the members on this committee have some long-standing familiarity with the department, and we also have one member of the committee who's new to the legislature and probably has not had as much involvement with our department over time. So what I thought would be best today, after some initial conversation with you, Madam Chair, around some hearings that are going to be held this session, not to get into too great detail on some of the issues, because I know they're going to be topics for freestanding hearings, but to give you a cursory summary of the department's operations, some of the things that we've had had happen over the last year, some of the challenges we faced, some of the success stories from the last year, and also some of the initiatives that are going to be before this body during this session, if that pleases the chair. As a really high-level summary of the department, we've got a really good mission. I think it's the best mission of all departments in the state of Alaska, and that is to promote and protect the health and well-being of all Alaskans. And that's what we do. We're a very large department. We're the largest department in state government by any measure, which brings a lot of responsibility to those of us who manage the department. But in terms of employees and total budget, we are the largest department in state government, and we carry out this very large and very encompassing mission. And there are some aspects of the department that people associate with the department readily, public health nursing, for example, perhaps our lab capacity. But there are many things people don't associate with the Department of Health and Social Service, such as we run the medical examiner agency for the state of Alaska, vital statistics, all the juvenile detention facilities for Alaska. So I'll walk very briefly through some of the subject areas that the department encompasses, and feel free, as the chair advised, to interject yourself liberally and ask any questions that you might have. We have three key principles that guide just about everything we do in the department, regardless of the agency, from juvenile justice to senior services to our behavioral health programs to our Office of Children's Services and our Medicaid program. And that's first and foremost that every one of our program operations are about developing and enhancing the ability of Alaskans to provide for themselves. We're an agency about self-sufficiency. How do you intervene as an agency, oftentimes at a moment when families are in crisis, to interject, to help build supports, to bring treatment, to bring assistance, aid, counsel into a family or into an individual's life, and then empower them through skills so that they can benefit themselves and provide for themselves and their families going into the future. So as we look at all of our program operations, particularly when we enter into moments of change, how are we implementing good decision-making and good programmatic guidance so that we are promoting self-sufficiency of all Alaskans? That's probably our number one key principle, which governs all of our operations in the department. The second one is an acknowledgement, and it's an acknowledgement that not everyone can provide for themselves, and that degree of self-sufficiency will vary by individual. And so with that acknowledgement that not everyone will always be able to be completely self-sufficient, you have to have a strong and vibrant safety net. And so that's sort of the second key principle that guides the way we structure our programs in the department. And the third is acknowledging that we are a young and growing state in terms of population, and we also have tremendous needs, and we don't have the infrastructure that you see in other states. And for that reason, as we look at programmatic expansions, we look at ways that we can promote a healthy and safe Alaska by bringing services to underserved communities. And so as I go through the agencies, those three principles apply to all of the things that we do. We do deliver some core services inside the department. One of those core services is providing access to quality, safe, assisted living in a home-like setting across the state. Another thing that we do is we deliver an integrated behavioral health system, and I'll talk about that when I talk about one of our agencies, the Division of Behavioral Health. We promote stronger families and safer children. We manage health care for Alaskans in need. We address juvenile crime by promoting accountability and also looking at ways of implementing restorative justice, restoring the family and the victim and the offender and the community. We look at ways that we can provide for the self-sufficiency and basic needs of all Alaskans. We work to protect and promote the health and well-being through things such as bioterrorism preparedness, public health interventions, epidemiology, surveillance. And also, we work aggressively to promote the independence of Alaska seniors and disabilities, people with physical or developmental disabilities, to make sure they have access to the same opportunities our state affords all of us. And I think we create public value as an agency. One of the ways we create public value is we first and foremost make sure Alaskans are healthy. Are people showing up at work able to to contribute to their employer's workplace setting. Our kids showing up at the doors of our schools, healthy, fed, making sure they're ready to learn, and that our families healthy so that they can succeed and prosper in Alaska. Another public value we create is that we ensure that our children are safe and that our children are healthy. And we do that through a variety of agencies, the interactions of those agencies, through integrated services that we're trying to work incrementally on almost a daily basis to wrap those services around the consumer rather than developing them around the program themselves. We also assist low-income Alaskans into becoming self-sufficient. Cash benefits start the dialogue, but the real ultimate goal is a job and a paying and productive member of our society. We are working aggressively, and I hope this committee will be involved in the process around bringing our kids home and making sure that we can serve our kids with mental health issues and behavioral health issues close to home, close to their family and structural supports. And also, we prevent and mitigate threats to public health. We're doing that on a daily basis. You had one of our great agency directors, Dr. Richard Monsager, present to this committee last week, talking about some of the challenges we faced just in the last year alone around some norovirus outbreaks that we've seen and perhaps threats from SARS or re-escalation in our rates of tuberculosis. So those are some public values that we deliver. And I wanted to mention these three areas, our principles, our core services, and our public values up front. Because as you look at our agency, I think you have to make sure that all of our pieces are moving forward to accomplishing these. And if these are not the ones that we believe we should be working towards, we should have that discussion as well. But I think this is a good blueprint of how we're trying to move this agency forward and provide our services so we move the state forward in the coming years. Some basic facts that any overview will have is that we have about 3,200 full-time positions that are budgeted. We have a number of other part-time positions. Of those positions, about 1,600 are direct field workers. These are what some people call frontline workers, but they include public health nurses. We have almost 300 social workers, 303 eligibility work service folks in the field and field offices. We have 260 staff just to try and operate our psychiatric institute, which is based in Anchorage. We have 619 staff that are involved in providing services in our Pioneer Home system. 264 employees that are dedicating their lives right now to staffing our youth detention facilities, also our treatment services and our probation services, and actually probation servicers themselves and probation workers, that's 88 employees. So we have a lot of employees, and they're all working together, and I think constructively, to accomplish that mission of the department. Our services, in terms of the scope and reach, in any given month, we're probably providing services to a little over 100,000 Alaskans, 90 to 100,000 Alaskans in any given month. We're providing health coverage right now through Medicaid to roughly 128 to 130,000 Alaskans. And I'll talk about that in a minute. We have a chart to show the rapid growth of our Medicaid program. We are managing 41 state-owned facilities. We have 80 facilities that are leased, and they are located in over 100 communities. We manage about $150 million worth of grants, and these are grants that go out from the agency to local, largely nonprofits in the community who are providing services from substance abuse treatment services, mental health counseling, a whole myriad of services that are being delivered. But we administer those grants on an annual basis, and they go out as one of the ways in which we finance our delivery system in the state. And we administer about $900 million in federal funds. Those dollars are largely to help finance the federal portion of our Medicaid program, but we also receive federal funds for things like substance abuse and our child protection system. The total budget for the department in the governor's FY06 budget submission is $1.813 billion. We are a large department, and virtually half of that is other funds or state funds. Organizationally, in the commissioner's office, I am the commissioner of the department. Carlene Jackson, who joins me, is one of our deputy commissioners. We also have another deputy commissioner. His name is Tony Lombardo. You'll see him often this session. Carlene is more of the day-to-day oversight of all of our program operations, sort of the more traditional definition of a deputy commissioner. Tony oversees our system enhancements, looking at oversight of the Medicaid program, looking at fraud and abuse, audit control, program integrity. He takes on more of the project system, inside system projects, while Carlene looks more at the programs that interact with the public. And we have one other deputy commissioner who I know has come before this committee before and will be here this session as well, and her name is Marcy Kanai. And she is the deputy commissioner overseeing the Office of Children's Services. We have an assistant commissioner who this legislature has worked with for a large number of years, Janet Clark, and I don't mean to imply that she's old, just that she knows a lot. And Janet's here again, and she serves as an assistant commissioner and handles what we call finance and management services. Our agency does not have a division of administrative services. One of the things we did during our initial days in office was to eliminate the division of administrative services. It was a division of process. And we had redundant capacity throughout the department. Every one of the agencies had their own admin service staff. One of the things we wanted to do was to work towards acknowledging up front that we have a finite pot of money that's been invested in this department to accomplish this mission. We need to work together more collaboratively, and one way to accomplish that was to integrate all of our budget and finance positions into one shop and acknowledging that those resources are there to accomplish the mission of the department, not just the division. So Janet oversees that. It's called Finance and Management Services, and it encompasses the old Division of Administrative Services and some staff that were out in the divisions themselves who are now working through an integrated delivery setting. We also have seven other directors, and these seven directors, joined by Marcy Kanai, the eight of them run what are effectively eight separate agencies inside the department that all move forward to accomplish that overall arching goal of the department, which is the health and well-being of all Alaskans. I'll walk very quickly through what those agencies are. Sure.
If you excuse me, but we have, just for the record, we have three more legislators in the audience, Representative Kelly, Hawker, and Coghill. And if you would like to come forward and sit up here, you're welcome to do that as we hear the overviews. Any of you would like to move forward, you sure can.
Thank you. Thank you. First agency, I'll take these alphabetically. I was trying to figure out how to engage them for this session. I thought alphabetically made the most sense. And this one is alphabetically now first because its name changed in the last year. And that was part of one of the restructuring efforts that occurred during the first year was to move the Pioneer Home System out of the Department of Administration into the Department of Health and Social Services. Historically, the Department of Health and Social Services always had jurisdiction over assisted living, except for the Pioneer Homes, the ones we run ourselves. And as we looked at ways in which we want to integrate our delivery system for senior services, particularly as you get into when you need to receive services either in the home or in a home-like setting or in an institution, we thought that that planning and that administration needs to be working in concert. So the Alaska Pioneer Homes are now part of the Department of Health and Social Services. We're glad to have them, and I know that they appreciate being in our department as well. But this agency is going through a little bit of change right now, and namely around something the legislature did last session that the governor encouraged, which is passing legislation that allows us to transition the Palmer Home into a veterans home as well. And that's been a lot of work. It doesn't get a lot of attention on a daily basis, but the process of going through the grant application, working with two different fund sources, we have general funds providing capital for the improvements to the Palmer facility, and also working with the Veterans Administration at the federal level to get their capital, because this was largely financed through federal capital dollars, license the beds, get the approval for the beds to be able to bill so that we can get veterans benefits for the veterans that are going to be in that home. It's a lot of work, and we've got some good employees been working on that over the last year. But the Alaska Pioneer Homes are one of our agencies, and we're operating six homes right now. They are assisted living homes. One is in Anchorage, by far the largest, but we also have homes in Fairbanks, Palmer, Juneau, Sitka, and Ketchikan. Most of the interaction around the Pioneer Home system during the legislative session is around deferred maintenance, capital costs. These are older facilities. The needs of the facilities are getting greater on a yearly basis. We were able to knock off a little bit of the deferred maintenance last year through the benefits of additional federal monies we received as a part of transitioning one of the homes into a veterans home. But we'll continue to have dialogue with the legislature this session. And we work with a Pioneer Home Advisory Board, which has a very active group of citizens who serve on that, who work with us collaboratively to develop an actual list of how we're going to take on the maintenance projects in the coming years and prioritizing them. One of the challenges the Alaska Pioneer Homes are facing, and it's a great challenge. It's a great challenge for all of our institutions, but certainly our assisted living homes, the Pioneer Home system, is the increasing prevalence in our resident population for Alzheimer's and dementia. We are operating assisted living homes. Our staffing is higher than that is necessarily needed for assisted living because we're delivering a much higher level of care in the homes on a daily basis. I know the chairs visited a number of our Pioneer homes, I'm sure, over the years. And as you notice, as we're starting to transition into a different demographic, many of the residents of the homes are staying in the homes, but they're moving from maybe level one care, which is our lowest level of care, up to level two, level three care. The Alzheimer and dementia burden being placed upon the staff and on the facility is and it's great and it's growing and requires additional staffing. It requires a much higher, almost higher medical model for the way we're delivering the care in the homes. And that's an issue we'll probably need to discuss this session as well. Some of the accomplishments of the last year for the Alaska Pioneer Homes, one is moving forward constructively to gain the federal approval for the 79 beds that we're going to be operating out of the Palmer facility. We hope to have some more events up in the Palmer area around the summertime with some of the veterans groups to finalize some of the details, but we plan on having that project done soon. It still is well over a year away. We've been working during the last year to enroll residents for Medicaid benefits. One of the, I think, really good accomplishments from the department during the last year was to do a lot of research and move forward on making the enrolling the Pioneer Homes as a Medicaid provider so that we could bill for Medicaid services. You say, what's the benefit of getting Pioneer Home residents to enroll in Medicaid if we already have, and as many already know, we have an assistance program for residents who enter the Pioneer Homes who don't have the means to pay for the entire rent or services they receive. We have an assistance program from the state. What does it mean to say now you're going to become a Medicaid provider as well? And oh, now as residents, we're going to have to enroll in Medicaid if available. The important thing about that is we still have a large number of our residents who are receiving services outside of the home. They live in the assisted living home, but perhaps they see a doctor outside of the home, or perhaps they get prescriptions outside of the home, not all, but some. And for all of those medical services they receive outside of the home now, we now have them enrolled in Medicaid, and they have a health insurance product. That means that their family's not going to have to bear the burden when that senior needs to leave the home to receive an additional health care service. So this is something that not only benefits the system, we're able to generate a little bit more federal money for the rates that are being charged for the bed capacity, but also is going to benefit the residents as well. And once that's explained to the families, they've appreciated it. Another big activity of the agency is it is the one, Alaska Pioneer Homes, that had to convert, get up and running and do the eligibility and convert over seniors who were moving on to the cash assistance program, which we call the Alaska Senior Assistance Program, which was the $120 a month, and then transition them over to the senior care benefit that this legislature passed during the last session. And that was done very successfully, and we have over 7,000 seniors receiving that cash benefit right now. And I think one of the subtler successes is that we've been able to maintain our staffing. And it's been very competitive and it's been very challenging operating a healthcare facility where you have to maintain your licensure standards naturally, but also to have good qualified staff working in those homes. And we're in a very competitive marketplace with the private providers, and not just in this own state, but also outside, nationally in the lower 48. Tremendous healthcare professional shortages, particularly around institution-based staff. And keeping that staffing level up has been a challenge, but it's been accomplished during the last year. Second operating agency within the department is the Division of Behavioral Health. And the Division of Behavioral Health is a product of an integration effort that was undertaken by this administration during our first year. When I came into office, we previously had three separate entities that were responsible for providing these behavioral health services to the state of Alaska. We had a division of alcohol and drug abuse. We had a division of mental health and developmental disabilities. And we also had an office of fetal alcohol syndrome. One thing we knew is overwhelmingly the consumers that received one of these services were receiving a whole host of these services across the agencies. They had co-occurring disorders. It wasn't just a substance abuse problem, but it was also depression, often undiagnosed by that person with a substance abuse problem who only goes to see a substance abuse counselor. So we moved forward during our first year with the creation of an integrated agency called the Division of Behavioral Health. And the Division of Behavioral Health does bring in these aspects and a few other things, such as tobacco enforcement. But what it does for the first time ever in this state is creates a truly integrated behavioral health system, which recognizes that a significant amount of the consumers that we're seeing in our programs have co-occurring disorders. What is this going to mean for the consumer? What it means as we deliver not just an integrated division, but an integrated delivery system. Our grants are going to go out to communities in a way in which we are going to work to create integrated delivery systems in the community. What it means to a consumer is that there's going to be no wrong door, and you're not going to fall through a gap, and you're also not going to see a revolving door of services because you're getting treated for one of your problems but not all of your problems at the same time. For the consumer, it means that when you walk in the door, once we move to a completely integrated system, when you walk into the door, in some cases it'll be the same provider, but in many communities it'll be different providers who have a working relationship and arrangement together. It means you walk in that door and say you are a person with a co-incurring disorder, which is the majority. We're going to have a system in place that, first of all, diagnoses all of your behavioral health problems, not just the substance abuse problem, but also the mental health problem if it exists. And then, more importantly, already has in place a delivery system in that community so that person can receive the services for both the substance abuse and the mental health condition. We'll be able to, through this integrated delivery system, to drastically cut down on the large number of consumers that come into the system. They get diagnosed with one of their problems, not all of their problems. They receive treatment for one of their problems, not all of their problems. We pay for that with state resources, ineffectively. Then they come back into the system 2 months, 3 months down with another acute care episodic interaction with the healthcare system, and another crisis enters into that person's life, and magically what we just treated is back again. What we have to have is an integrated delivery system. It's a change, and it's a challenge to local communities. And what we've said to local communities as we move towards integrated grants, the way we put the funding into the community to deliver those services, is you don't have to lose your identity. You don't have to change. You don't have to merge. You don't have to consolidate. All we're saying is you in Ketchikan or you in Wrangell or you in whatever community, work together. Come together. We worked with SAMHSA at the federal level to secure a systems improvement grant, a co-occurring systems improvement grant, that we now have technical assistance capacity. SAMHSA at the federal level is adamant in pushing states into this direction, really wants to support us. They gave us a $3.5 million grant to help us facilitate this effort at the local level. We have technical assistance. We have trained staff. We're ready to go into communities and then, first of all, engage that community in a dialogue and then work with the providers themselves to bring their systems together. And it means that you have to talk and that you have to make sure that you have an arrangement in place, sort of a web in place amongst the care providers in that community, so that when the person shows up at provider Y and has needs that provider Y and X both provide, that they've talked to each other and they know when that person leaves that door that they're going to have access to that continuum of services. This is going to it's a tremendous change. And to say it hasn't been a burden on the agency to get this done is an understatement. It's very easy for us to say this is where we want to go. It's a much greater challenge to get it done at the grassroots level and at the frontline level. And what we have complete alignment from the Mental Health Trust, from my department, from my commissioner's office, and from the agency executives is that this is the right thing to do. Timing, dialogue, collaboration with the communities has been the challenge. We've been doing a number of integration programs across the state. Bill Hogan has been traveling across the state, Diane Casto, other individuals from within the agency, having those meetings. We went down to Ketchikan recently. We've gone to a number of communities to actually move this forward. What many people don't know is we've already integrated 25 communities. Already done, 25 communities. By FY 2006, we'll have the balance of the state done, save for three large communities, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, and those will be in 2007. But we've already integrated a number of communities, and it's working. And what we've seen from these integrations is tremendous success. And I know Bill Hogan, our director of behavioral health, will be here to talk about some of these successes around the integration and our Bring the Kids Home initiative at a later hearing. But some of the great things we've seen is true capacity growth with no new dollars. We had one community which, from the integration themselves, they've been able to deliver about an extra $100,000 worth of services with no new money. It's by looking at the on-tap capacity that they had when they worked together, they're able to realize those savings. And what we also knew was there are a number of communities that already did this. I think of Petersburg. Already had an integrated system. They were ahead of the state. So to say that we're pushing something into the communities and we're the great ones who thought this up is quite an overstatement. A number of communities have already realized this and have already moved forward, and we're actually following a national model, and it's going to be a great success.
Commissioner, I have a question. Are you finding that of the ones that you've already have got in place, is it working better for them to kind of merge their agencies together, or are most of them staying complete separate?
I would say the ones that were – obviously, it's fair to say that when we chose which communities – to move into the first round, the second phase, and the third phase. We looked at sort of, I guess, an Olympic scoring terminology, the degree of difficulty. And we certainly moved in the first year towards those that were closest, or already maybe have already integrated. And what you'll see in those communities is that that those initial ones were overwhelmingly already an integrated agency, not completely. Many of them were in rural communities where you had perhaps a native health corporation delivering the services. They're integrated delivery systems, so those were much easier to move forward on. But we've had a little bit of each, and I don't think one model it works best in any one community. I think we're, you know, you'll hear from my agency and I guess from our state, we'll always talk about how one size doesn't fit all, and I think we accept that in this. What we've said to communities is, we really don't care. You may find it's better to integrate. We had one community where it's worse to integrate agencies because one agency was under a local government operation and one was not. And to actually integrate under that, you would bring a whole host of employees into the pension plan for the local government, and then it was going to cost a lot of money. And so you have to look at all these various factors around service delivery, technical capacity, facilities. Look at actually facilities. And then also look at overall operating costs and make that local decision. What we want to do is have the dialogue, encourage the dialogue, and provide any technical assistance that communities want. A number of legislators have called me because they've heard of an integration effort going on in one of the cities that's in their district or one of the villages in their district, and we've responded to all those inquiries, and to date we've had nothing but success thus far. I think as we go on, as we get into much larger population bases, and as we get into some communities where the delivery system is so fractured right now, I revert back to something our director, Bill Hogan, once said, which is that when people talk about the difficulty of building the system, they have to at least acknowledge that right now there isn't even a system. We talk about it, the mental health system, but normally systems don't have gaps in them to the extent that we see right now. One thing I'll briefly mention about behavioral health, and I'll keep moving along, is something that a lot of people don't realize we do in our agency is something called SINAR enforcement. We're under SINAR, S-Y-N-A-R. And SINAR enforcement deals with a federal requirement that states have to do essentially illegal, looking at illegal sales of tobacco products to minors using confidential informants. And states have to go out. We hire confidential informants. These are individuals who are below the legal age of purchasing tobacco products in the state of Alaska. And in Alaska, that age is 19. So we hire individuals under the age of 19. And we actually accompany them with a law enforcement professional, and they go into our tobacco retailers. Some of them are the large box stores. Some of them are smaller retailers across the state in rural regions and urban regions. And we present lawful, honest identification if asked, which shows that the individual is below the age to purchase tobacco products. And then we keep data on that. How often were we able to purchase illegally tobacco products as a minor? And we also naturally accompany this with sanctions on retailers. And people have probably seen during the last year, occasionally we sanction a retailer and you'll see a sign up that says we can't sell tobacco for a week or a month or whatever the sanction is. What I can tell you is our success is not by penalizing the merchants, it's by working with the merchants. And we've had really good dialogue, retailer education, where retailers bring us in, let us do presentations, some of the larger retailers let us do presentations to their workforce and train them. We worked really cooperatively and well with Walmart, for example, who now require that if you buy a tobacco product, it used to be check the ID. Now the cashier actually has to type in on the keypad on the register what their date of birth is off of their license. They didn't want to get sanctioned either, and they worked with us cooperatively. But SINAR is a federal requirement that says not just you have to do this, but you have to report your data back to Washington. And if you have a variance or you have an error rate above 20%, that's the federal benchmark, your illegal sale rate can be 20%. One time out of five when that minor walks in, who works for the state naturally, walks into a merchant and attempts to buy a tobacco product presenting legal identification that shows they're below the legal age to purchase tobacco, one out of five times you can be successful and be compliant with the federal law. But if you're over one out of five, over 20%, you actually have a sanction. And the sanction comes out of your SAMHSA block grant. And SAMHSA is the federal agency that oversees substance abuse and mental health issues. And they give a block grant to the state of Alaska for some substance abuse services. And if you don't meet your target, your 20% target, you lose 40% of that substance abuse block grant. That's the penalty. They have a caveat. if you miss your target, by the degree you miss it,
the state,
that's our penalty from the federal government. And by the degree that you miss your target, that 20% target, you can, in lieu of absorbing the 40% penalty to your SAMHSA block grant, you can pay essentially a cash penalty from your state general fund to your tobacco enforcement program to enhance your program to make sure you do a better job doing retailer compliance and compliance with the law. And as I said, that penalty is basically derived by how much you miss that 20%. If you miss it by 12 points, you can sometimes in 1 year pay almost $250,000 in penalties. When I came into office, and remember the target was 20%, when I came in, this chart shows your illegal tobacco sales rate. The state had never reached its 20% target. In 1996, we were successful 34.3% of the time. 99, 34%, 2000, 36%, 2001, 27%, 2002, 30.2%. And the one thing I did not mention about these penalties is they're cumulative. They don't go away after 1 year. So if you're sanctioned 1 year, the next year you have to pay two penalties, and then your next penalty is on top of all the other penalties. We were about 1 year away from paying almost $1 million in penalties, the cumulative effect. We went aggressively during the last 2 years to really target this, to work aggressively with retailers and to try to turn this around. I think this is one of the success stories of the Department of Health and Social Services. As you can see, in 2003, we were able to bring our illegal sale rate down from 30.2% to 10%. We have our data in right now for 2004. It has not been finalized. Our data gets presented to the federal government. They sort of audit it and look at it, so it's not been finalized. But we're probably going to be a little bit over 10%, but right around in the same neighborhood for 2004. The number will come in sometime, but somewhere between 10 and 12%. So we're going to be compliant for the second year straight, no risk of penalties. But this has been something we're really proud of, and this is something that's done by workers. And for the 2003, it was run by workers in the Division of Public Health, but this year it's in the Division of Behavioral Health.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Garner.
Thank you. I have a question about this. Mm-hmm. Have your studies over the past, 7 years, shown that there's any degree or any way to predict in terms of box stores, neighborhood stores, urban or rural? Are there some categories of tobacco sales where it's more likely that they will not be in compliance? And then the second part of that question is, when you do the work with the confidential informants, how are the locations chosen?
Right. Well, to sell tobacco in the state of Alaska, you do have to have a license from the state. So we do a randomized enforcement protocol that is random, and it's done in conjunction with we have investigators, we have our confidential informants who are the individuals under the age of 18, and law enforcement also works with us as well. But it is a random selection process. Now, to your first question, which is probably the much more important question, which is who's doing a better job, it varies. I think typically the more rural and the smaller the community, the higher the illegal sale rate. The larger retailers and more urban areas, we have and this is again a gross generalization because it's not fair to extrapolate this to any one retailer. We've got tremendous retailers all across the state are doing a good job in rural and urban. And we also have another challenge we have is you work with confidential informants when you try to do the enforcement in very remote and rural communities. You're talking about a community that maybe has 100, 150, 200 people in that community. The day three new people show up in town and want to buy tobacco, it's a little, it is. I mean, it raises some eyebrows. And so there have always been some challenges with trying to get good data in some of the more rural areas. But it varies. But naturally, the larger box stores, normally it takes one sanction, but we've worked cooperatively with them, and I think it's been a great success story. I can tell you that this is not, and I say this to everyone I present this data to, this is not because we're issuing more sanctions, and this is not because we're penalizing more merchants. We couldn't accomplish this if it wasn't for the really heroic and great work being done by the retailers to work with their, and they have great turnover in their frontline workers, just like we do in the state of Alaska. And they're putting a new person on a register almost on a weekly basis in most of these retailers, and to actually take the time and with the low margin that they operate on, to work constructively with us, to use the materials we provide, sometimes go through the training we have, and to make sure that they hold their employees to that same standard has been a great accomplishment. It's really been their hard work in conjunction with our hard work that's gotten this done, and I appreciate it for their work. A couple other things about behavioral health that we're going to talk about this session. One of them is bring the kids home. This is an initiative by Governor Murkowski to address the problem that we have, which is a large number of children who are receiving services out of state, who we think should be getting those services in state. And what we always refer to in the Bring the Kids Home is this visual image of bringing these kids home. But most likely these children are going to age out of the programs they're in out of state. What we're really talking about is defining the continuum of care from high-level residential care down to lower-level care such as group homes, therapeutic foster care, defining that continuum of care, building it in Alaska, and having a good gatekeeping system with it to make sure that when a child enters our behavioral health system at a young age, that we can direct that kid to, first and foremost, a local service in their community, and ideally in the least restrictive setting outside of a residential placement. We think we can do that in state. We can do think we can do that with a larger number of kids outside of residential, read expensive, read not always best, non-residential settings. And we can do that very quickly, we think. And we've got a proposal in our budget this year. I know this isn't a budget committee hearing, but we have a budget request that's in our budget that the governor has put forward, a $5 million starting point to help kickstart our Bring the Kids Home initiative. And that's not all general fund. Part of that is our department kicking in money, but it's also the Mental Health Trust. Mental Health Trust and the trustees have been very supportive of this initiative and bringing the kids home. Occasionally we disagree about how we're going to do it, but we have a planning process for that, and we've worked through those difficult times around planning. But right now it's about starting the process. And I know that you're going to have a hearing on this. We won't talk about it, but that's an issue that's out there for this agency to focus on. And one other thing I'll mention is that we do have the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, which is a hospital that we run in this agency, in this division. And it's being replaced. For those of you who are in the legislature for at least a few sessions, you know it's been a big issue. Was replacing the Alaska Psychiatric Institute up in Anchorage. It's a high-dollar replacement, slightly over $40 million. It was a design build, and as a result of that, it's a better building than we ever thought we were going to be able to get. It's on time. It's under budget. And it's opening on time. And in fact, I think Janet's around. Janet gets more credit than I do. We're gonna get this thing open probably before the end of the fiscal year. That's our goal. So before the end of the fiscal year, we'll have that building open. And it is gorgeous. I mean, just a beautiful building. If you have a chance to visit it up in Anchorage, it's worth seeing. We've got some exciting things we're doing in the Division of Behavioral Health through API. Not just a new building, but we're moving our entire treatment paradigm towards recovery. In fact, the governor had an announcement at the facility end of last year, the governor had an announcement up there that we're actually renaming the program, the adult program in the facility, to a recovery program, the Alaska Recovery Center. Wow. And even more exciting is that Ron Adler, who's the director of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, who I have to find on a daily basis ways to keep him from leaving me, he's running telebehavioral health services out of API and providing through live video conferencing through some IT equipment that we were able to purchase for him, and equipment that he's been able to get donated, and funding that's come from the Alaska Telehealth Advisory Council and the Mental Health Trust. We're able to run without much attention yet, but I think we're going to get more attention in the coming year. We're running behavioral health services out of our Alaska Psychiatric Institute to remote communities who never had access to services before, and more particular, the complete challenge that the state sees, let alone a rural community sees, to try to find an adolescent psychiatrist or some of these more specialty disciplines within psychiatry. We're delivering the services right now, distance delivery to Fort Yukon.
Are you talking about like counseling sessions themselves? Wow.
The child sitting on the other end of the equipment, and our clinicians largely working out of API. On this side, you can zoom in, you can see a tear in the eye. I mean, it's a great program. We're always looking for new resources to get this moving forward. We've had tremendous support from our congressional delegation, Senator Stevens in particular. As I said, from the Telehealth Advisory Council and the Mental Health Trust Authority and our department. Ron, who brought this passion with him from when he worked in Ketchikan at Gateway, has been doing this, and we're getting remote sites up left and right. But Fort Yukon and a few others, we're doing services to the Slope. This is going to be a real cutting-edge thing that I think the state can be very proud of. Third agency I'll talk about inside the department. I'll try and speed up a little bit. I know you certainly don't want me to talk any faster, but certainly get through the agencies a little quicker. The third one is the Office of Children's Services. This is an integrated agency. Went through an integration my first year in office. I am passionate personally about trying to find ways that we can integrate our services and move beyond talking about programs and silos, but rather talk about what we're going to do for an individual. What are we going to do for this parent? What are we going to do for this child? What are we going to do for this family? What are we going to do for this community? And we have to look at all the programs we do in our department as a portfolio of services that we need to wrap around the person we're serving. And one of the ways you do that and get rid of the silos is by integrating the way you actually deliver those services. And we talked about behavioral health. One other one here is the Office of Children's Services. The previous activities from the Division of Family and Youth Services, such as child protection, foster care, adoption, continue, but we also rolled in other children's services, such as the Infant Learning Program, which provides services to developmentally delayed children. We look at the WIC program, nutrition services for low-income women and children, healthy families. These programs we brought all together around the Office of Children's Services during the last year, did a really good strategic planning session with external and internal partners and stakeholders. And what the agency came back to, and all the people who participated on that came back to, is that the strategic plan has to be built around a prevention model. It's our children's services and our child protective services cannot be designed as sort of what Dr. Monsager referred to in our public health structure, which is sort of this firehouse model, where you drill, 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 and then you need yourself. Our child protection services have to be out there on day one from birth to find ways that we can prevent child abuse and neglect in our state. And what we know is that families that come into programs in our department are increasingly more likely to end up in our child protection services than those who were not involved in other programs. So we know that families that come into perhaps because they're families in crisis, they come into our substance abuse programs, they come into our cash assistance programs for low income. It's not to generalize, but we know that there is a direct correlation between child poverty and child neglect. And we have to look at ways in which we can integrate all of our service delivery around a prevention model. So the Office of Children's Services came forward, and as I mentioned, Deputy Commissioner Kanai handles that. We have 27 local offices, and they're around the state, and they deliver a variety of services focusing on prevention. I mentioned the Infant Learning Program. One of the things we have seen over the last 2 years is an increase in the enrollment in the Infant Learning Program, which is a good thing. We're getting in touch and providing services to kids at a younger age. These are below the age of 3, so that we can start addressing some of these delays early before they show up at school at 5 or 6 years of age and then are diagnosed with a delay. And our wait list has decreased. In FY 2002, our wait list was 176, and by closeout of 2004, our wait list was down to 133. So we had seen our wait list decline by about 35%. Our WIC program is providing a large amount of services. We're serving right now about 26,000 individuals per month with nutritional support. Our program improvement plan, which was put in place, there was what's called the CFSR, Child Family Service Review. This was the high-profile federal review of the Child Protective Service that came in the summer of 2002 and gave a review, looked at 7 areas, and found the state deficient in a number of those areas in our Child Protective Services. Quite honestly, every state failed. And it's not a review that's set up to make sure states check, pass, pass, pass. It's about surveying where you're at. It's below the benchmark we want to get you to, setting new benchmarks, measuring again. When you achieve them, we set a new benchmark. It's about continuous and sustained improvement in your child protective services.
Commissioner, I want to just jump back.
Okay.
When you said that there was an increase on the wait list or decrease in the wait list by like 30-some percent, mm-hmm. What's the goal? I mean, are you going to try to get by the next year, get that totally taken care of, or where's our goal at?
I'm not sure we've set a specific numerical target. We may have in the division-specific performance measures. I'd have to look at those again. Naturally, we'd want to get to a point where we don't have a wait list for the services. We're a department that's dedicating as much of the resources as possible towards early intervention and prevention models. So naturally, it's not always a resource problem. Sometimes it is, such as a wait list. It's not always a resource problem, and we have to do outreach as well. But our goal is to make sure that we can get the children who are experiencing developmental disabilities identified very early in the system and receiving services. Around the program improvement plan, as a result of the Child Family Services Review that came in 2002, we, like all states who go through that process, were challenged with developing a program improvement plan. This was our blueprint on how we're going to improve our child protective system. Our program improvement plan was submitted and approved in the summer of 2003. That triggered a two-year process of actually implementing the program improvement plan. You'll often hear it referred to by my staff as the PIP. But the program improvement plan is negotiated with the federal government. You have 2 years to implement it. It's built around some core areas: permanency, safety, and well-being of children. It's a completely driven by performance measures, and they're negotiated. I know that some members of this committee have heard about this during other hearings. I assume there'll be an oversight hearing around Office of Children's Services and the program improvement plan perhaps specifically, and we can walk through all those performance measures. But what we have seen during the last year is we're knocking off a number of the performance measures that we have in the PIP, particularly around safety. We still have some challenges that we have to address in the coming year, though, before we close out the program improvement plan. One thing I would just share as a chart here, when I approached the governor a little over a year ago asked him to move forward on a way to improve our child protective services by investing in more frontline workers and lowering the caseload, and he was very supportive of that effort. We put forward to the legislature in the last budget round a request to add 26 new positions to the Office of Children's Services, investing in our priorities, a consistent message from this governor. In this upcoming budget, we again are investing in our priorities, which is about early intervention and keeping our children, our families, and our communities safe. And so we're requesting additional positions. And these positions are going for a couple of things. We brought a new IT system up and running called ORCA, which stands for the Online Resources of the Children of Alaska. This is an information system that runs our child protective services and all of our case records, moving away from paper to IT. These are nationally called SACWIS systems. It's a little too technical, but what you've seen, though, is that investment's paying off. We're starting to see through better use of IT and through investments of additional resources. And, of course, we have more requested for 06. But what we see is that sort of triangle straight line, that's the Child Welfare League of America standards, which is your caseload should be 15. We're still above it. We're meeting it in a couple areas. We've always been fortunate in Southeast Alaska because of population. We tend to have a little bit more staff in Southeast just because you've got transportation problems with small communities. So our per capita and per case caseworker is obviously well below the national average. But it's no secret that Anchorage is still having a tremendous challenge, and we need to get more resources out to them. This does not include the additional resources that the governor is investing in his budget for 2006. So that'll help bring that caseload down again. And I really appreciate the support I've had from legislators in trying to improve this system. The investment last year has paid off, and we've got a good proposal for this upcoming year.
Was it 30 new workers? I can't remember.
I think the final total was 32. Is it 30?
There's actually 34.
Great. Right. They're not all frontline social workers. For example, one piece of that collection of positions is to ensure, I mentioned this new information technology system we brought up. Well, it's great for the computer experts out there to have a new IT system put into your desktop or into your office and say, this is what you have to use now. It's a whole different thing for someone who's been using paper for a long period of time. And it's a new system. And so one piece of that position request is to make sure that we have in every one of our regional offices an ORCA expert, a person, an IT person who's there who can help walk the caseworkers through it and make sure that we have an expert in each shop who can direct. This is not every office, but all our regional offices, making sure we have that expert.
Representative
Stevens? Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Joel, I've been informed that some of the areas are having a real problem with that system. That's taking mm-hmm. that they're, you know, taking 15 minutes to change a screen, and I guess it's improved a little yeah. bit. But it seems like if we're going to go to IT, we also need to have those offices on broadband or something, because at 56K, it's actually slowing down yeah. the process. Have you within the department budgeted for that, or have any program for getting those? Making that functional system.
Okay, responding to the chair, I'll defer to Jen if there's a budget increment associated with that for 2006. I'm not aware of one, though. There might be. Is there?
Chair, Representative Seaton, there is a budget request to update some of the hardware. We found we have very old machines on the desks that also need to be improved. So there is a budget increment for that. We're also looking at this issue about access to some of the areas that don't have a good broadband functionality, and we're talking with the Department of Administration on that. We pay for that in our chargeback rate, so there is not a specific budget for that, but we're looking to see how we can improve that.
Madam Chair.
Follow-up?
Just so we're aware, I mean, basically Homer is not out in the bush,
right.
But there's six people trying to, I think it's six computers trying to share a single 56K line, and so the system may be great, but I know that the people there are being delayed by the new system. So anyway, if you could address that further at some other time, I'd appreciate it. Thank you,
Mr. Bonk, the Chair, we're happy to do that. I think one thing that I knew when I came into this job, but certainly have had reinforced on a daily basis, is there's no such thing as a smooth implementation of a new IT plan. We as a department, I'm still correct in saying this, we actually run the largest, our actual infrastructure is the largest IT infrastructure in the state of Alaska for the whole department. You include public assistance and all the servers and all the claims we're doing, and you look at our contractors as well. And we've got a large IT capacity. Overwhelmingly, we're working with legacy systems that are old. Our Medicaid system, the large MMIS system, is going through a re-procurement right now. We're bringing on a new MMIS system. This is Medicaid Management Information System. It's sort of the IT backbone of our. I talked about those 128,000 people who are on Medicaid. They're all carrying a card, and they want to walk into any doctor's office of their choice or any pharmacy of their choice and swipe that card, and we're processing the claim and keeping administrative claims data, not clinical data, but administrative claims data. It's a big administrative burden, and then you want to put into protocols of how many times a person can have access to a service, or you want to do case management, or maybe you want to implement new restrictions on certain types of drugs if they're being abused. Those are all interactions with this IT system. And this thing is from the 1970s. And so we're working to replace the system right now. We hope to have it up and running, the new system, at the end of this year, but it's going to have bumps along the road as well. What we have overwhelmingly right now, and it's something we're orderly trying to transition off of, but you can't do overnight, is move away from these piecemeal replacements of legacy systems and look more in a strategic way about how we're going to transition off of these individual legacy systems and move forward with a new paradigm, which is that all of our information systems are integrated around a common database. Because right now, every agency's legacy system has its own database. And so if you asked me right now, the worst question I ever, and Janet knows what the question I'm going to mention, if you asked me right now, how many people do I serve, I can't answer the question. I can tell you how many people I serve in this program, how many people I serve in this program, but I can't give you an unduplicated count because the database for each one of those programs is unique to that program, and there's not necessarily common identifiers in that data, so you can do matching across. There was an investment done around a data warehouse for the department and trying to dump the data together, and then using some predictors of, this John Smith was born in the same city and therefore they might be the same person. I mean, there's some methodologies you can use around that, but they're not very successful. Where we plan to transition, and actually the legislature last year funded a portion of, is this new effort around what we call the Master Client Index, which I think that's just a milestone in the entire event, but it's this overarching effort to move towards one philosophy, which is that we have applications, perhaps this ORCA system in OCS or in another agency, their own individual system, but we have these applications. They'll belong to the agencies, but the data belongs to the department, and that data needs to come into one centralized repository, or at least through protocols, it's shared, and then and the ultimate goal is when that worker, it doesn't matter what kind of worker it is, I don't care if it's a nurse or a social worker or who it is, but it's a worker, a caseworker, leaves my office in one of our rural areas and goes to the front door of a family, that person can have access to information not just about the one program that they run, but they can look at, is there a cash assistance program that's providing services to this family? What about public health? What about OCS? What about DJJ, which I'm going to get to, our Division of Juvenile Justice? We need to empower our frontline workers with that data and use the data across divisions to provide better interactions and better services for that family, and trying to remove some of the gaps through that information manning. That's when I know we've really succeeded. We've succeeded when a worker, a case worker from our agency, regardless of which program they come from, can make sure that the services they're delivering to that family encompass the entire portfolio of services we provide in the department, and they're being wrapped around that person. Now, there's HIPAA concerns, which you'll hear about during the session, which is about health insurance, privacy, and health privacy data. There's other protocols, but you can build those protocols into the system itself. You can say, this person has access to this type of information, or if you see this type of information, call this person. You're not going to have access to that data. And you can work through that through protocols, but we have to get our data at the point where a decision maker can use data across the department much more wisely.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I think this is hugely exciting and obviously has a lot of applications and could save a tremendous amount of effort. Is there an effort to go back to archives, for example, reports of harm that, there's a long history on a particular family? Or do you have adequate personnel to enter all that data?
I respond to the chair, Representative Gardner. The administrative, the simple side, data entry side is something that we've struggled with. We have, obviously, this legacy of information, which is paper. And it's in multiple volumes. There has been an effort undertaken during the last year to actually enter in. We've entered into some contracts with some entities as well to assist us in getting that data put into the system. Our goal, naturally, is to move away from having a paper repository and have all of it through information technology, but most of that's done through data entry. A large amount has been entered. It's actually shocking how much data they've actually gotten done. But there is always going to be this legacy challenge you have. And I think one of the challenges we have as we look around either integrating systems or integrating IT is that it's not a blank slate. You don't get to just build the building blocks from the ground up. You've got moving pieces, mm-hmm. some things that have been around for a long time, and you've got natural lifespans of systems that are not in sync. And so it's going to be a challenge to try and keep the planning ahead of the natural lifespans of the systems themselves. And that's why right now we're focusing on our standards, protocols, and looking at some of the vision pieces right now, knowing that these legacy systems are going to start to expire pretty soon. But even this MMIS reprocurement, or Medicaid Management Information System, the real sort of the granddaddy of them all, that project began before integration piece started right now. So we're kind of trying to shoehorn it after it's already gone halfway down the track into an effort to integrate the services.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joel, backing up just a little bit on some of the things we're talking about.
Sure.
In 2000 and 2002, I believe, the legislature adopted missions and measures. Mm-hmm. And then I know in 2003 and 2004, we worked over those a lot with you. And a lot of those are things mm-hmm. you're talking about. But the legislature did not adopt those mm-hmm. in a statutory framework in the budget process. And so I'm wondering, is there any conflict I know you're proceeding and you need to proceed and we appreciate that. Right. Is there any conflict or is there anything that we need to do to make these changes in mission and the outcome performances that you're proceeding with to dovetail with legislative guidelines or priority or statutory requirements?
At the risk of frightening Assistant Commissioner Clark, I'll certainly say that I think missions and measures should probably be updated on almost an annual basis in some cases, because there's always something new you're starting, there's some change or system. We're in a very, the Department of Health and Social Services is a unique department in a sense that we deal with science, we deal with things that are evolving much faster than many other industries are. And you look at even if you look at just economic growth around healthcare, the Department of Labor put out a publication of the 20 fastest growing careers in Alaska, and I think 13 of the top 15, including all of the top 10, were healthcare fields. So it's just this constant growth and change. We have to acknowledge there's going to be some change in the way we deliver services. I don't think there should be tremendous radical change, but certainly periodic review and updating. We within the department, even though we did not really end up with a real statutory resolution to missions and measures during the last session, we as a department have continued to move forward with an adamant belief and commitment towards performance measures. And what you'll see in our budget submission, and I know Assistant Commissioner Clark will be doing a budget overview presentation to the legislature as well, is that we've continued to move forward on performance measures. We're continuing to use them. I think we need to look and see where in the last time we passed them and what we have right now, and is there a need to harmonize those? And if so, I think we should do that. But I think we accept that there's going to be we all play different roles in this piece. The legislature plays a role, the executive branch plays a role, and the legislature really needs to be setting those targets for us. And then we have to see if we can hit them or not. But we need to look and make sure we're being responsive to the needs of the people of the state of Alaska as well. I think it's going to be a spirited dialogue. I'm not really answering your question well, except to say we're still committed to them. We're still using them. We're still collecting the data. In fact, we work to develop them. One of the things we've been working on the last year, which we referred to as developing, because it is a large department, as you can tell, because I'm only halfway through the divisions, it's very difficult for me myself as the commissioner to really monitor each one of these performance measures on a routine and periodic basis. You have to accept the people that you have as your director, as your deputy commissioner is doing that as well for their programs at a much deeper level. But how do we move towards developing a dashboard? That's what we refer to it as, a dashboard of performance measures. And so what we looked at during the last summer, I think in August, we met as a management team, and we developed, I think it's 10 measures, Janet, I could be wrong in the exact number, but 10 measures that we considered our dashboard measurements. And the theory being if we're doing pretty good in these 10 measures, we know the ones downstream are probably doing good okay as well. And so we tried to select these dashboard measures as things that we didn't have tremendous control over. You know, there's some degree of some natural variables that are in there that prevent us from having direct control over. It's not something we can easily manipulate as a performance measure. And also one that we know that if we're doing good in this one, it means downstream we're doing good things. A perfect example is the Alaska Pioneer Homes. We selected as our dashboard measure accidental falls, because we know if we're hitting our performance measure around accidental falls in the Pioneer Home system, we're probably keeping a clean home, we probably have our staff well trained, we probably know there's ample involvement of the public coming in and seeing the facilities. We know that these downstream things, or maybe upstream things, are working well if we're meeting this one performance measure. So we've also looked at it that way, about how we can streamline some of these measures and create sort of a dashboard as a quick look, either for the public or for legislators, on how we're doing around some measures, and keep that more frequently updated.
Follow-up? Yes. The follow-up is that I'm concerned that we have some statutory missions and measures that we've basically abandoned, but we may be requiring you to collect the data on and report, right. And the true missions and measures, which we want you following, that you are following, right, haven't been adopted by the legislature. And mm-hmm. So I think we have a public policy problem, and I'm not in opposition to any of the policies that you're doing, but I want to make sure that we dovetail those, and I would hope that your department, as well as the other departments, would come forward with a very crucial and aggressive note that we need to not only update administratively what you're going to do, but that we in the legislature adopt those policies and statutes so you can be following the law.
No.
And
I couldn't agree with you more, and I certainly hope the legislature and will participate vigorously in that discussion, providing information, looking at what we're doing right now, and also, as you mentioned, reporting on data that maybe they want to change what some of those performance measures are. The legislature may want to change them. I think we'll want to cooperate vigorously with that, in that dialogue and that discussion, and get that done this session. There's a natural process for that. I know that there were some challenges, particularly in the other body, last session around missions and measures. But I've had dialogue with a number of legislators individually, and I'm still getting the same feedback, a commitment towards missions and measures. And we certainly want to be part of that dialogue and get that done this session. I agree with you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Very, very briefly, healthcare services, another agency. This is more of a internal operation, healthcare services. It doesn't have a lot of frontline personnel. What we really focus on within healthcare services is just the actual administration of our Medicaid program. And what you'll see here is a chart, just to give you a little bit of background about our Medicaid program itself. And what you'll see in the bar chart is enrollment. And that is scaled on the left side of the chart. And you'll see our enrollment right now is pushing right about 130,000, a little below 130,000. And it's growing predictably. And what you'll see in the other line, the line going up, which is scaled on the right-hand side, is expenditures. These are total funds, not necessarily general funds. General funds make up about 35% of that. About 65% is federal, about 35% is general funds. But what you'll see is our expenditures this year, in 2004, we'll finish up just a little bit below, and that's fiscal year, we'll finish up just a little bit below $1 billion, and our FY 2006 will be the first year we actually crest over $1 billion. And that rapid growth is not uniform across all the services we provide. Some of our services we provide have been relatively flat, some small inflation in some programs. But some programs, and I know the chair's familiar with perhaps our personal care attendant program or some other programs, have grown exponentially. Our personal care attendant program in FY 2001 was about $8 million, and now it's over $70 million in just four fiscal years. So it's those programs that are driving a large part of this growth, and to some extent that's a policy decision. And I know that this committee and other committees will look at that during this session. But you in the legislature established most of the criteria around the Medicaid program, who we cover, eligibility, what services we provide. These are called optional services. We in the executive branch administer that program. We control some of that through regulation, but not much. What we really control is the reimbursement side, the rate setting side, and the way in which we do claims. So we don't have our foot on the brake pedal necessarily to be able to slow the program down. A lot of that requires legislative involvement. And it's a policy decision. The one thing we do know, though, is that Medicaid is an entitlement program. So when the legislature appropriates funds, a certain finite amount of funds, and we expend those funds perhaps in March, if Joe, Medicaid beneficiary, walks into their doctor's office the day after and presents their card, it's an entitlement program, we have to pay the claim. So what we try to do is as the legislature finishes up its appropriation, we then try to manage within that appropriation by doing through regulation some cost containment to try and slow the program down, but it's very difficult. It's very difficult through regulation to control this size of a program. It really has to be sculpted through legislation, and I'm sure there'll be some attention placed on that this session. The next division we have is juvenile justice. Juvenile justice is one of our operating divisions, one of my favorites personally, and they follow a restorative justice model, which is focused on seeking, first of all, to support the public safety goals of our prosecutors and of our law enforcement professionals in our communities. But we do this by not just holding the offender accountable for their behavior, but also restorative justice. And by restorative, we mean bringing the victim, the family, the community, and the offender back to their original state, healing. We take a tremendous pride in actually trying to find ways in which we can not just rehabilitate the kid, but also restore that community and that victim as well. We operate 17 field offices for juvenile justice and 8 youth facilities. And our youth detention facilities are around the state. We have one in Bethel, one in Nome, one in Anchorage, one in Mat-Su, one in Fairbanks, one in Juneau, and we also have one in Ketchikan. They vary in size. Anchorage is the largest one, McLaughlin. And 4 of them, Bethel, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, also provide long-term treatment services. We need those long-term treatment services because we do have some youth that are committed to the juvenile justice system for a long period of time. This is because the nature of the offense, a very serious offense, perhaps a violent offense, or chronic delinquent behavior, we know this child is going to be in the system for a long period of time, so they'll be served out of those 4 facilities. And all 4 of those facilities, Anchorage, Bethel, Juneau, and Fairbanks, they're accredited by the American Correctional Association. One of the things we've been focusing on during the last year and a half, is moving towards better use of data, better use of instruments, and getting away from a subjective juvenile justice system to an objective juvenile justice system. We do that one way. A couple of ways. One way is by we adopted something called a DAI, or Detention Assessment Instrument. And this is an actual system that we now use in our juvenile justice facilities. Before you put the child into detention, you basically look at various factors and various information, and this system uses objective rather than subjective criteria to decide whether or not that child really needs to be in the detention facility. That's a tremendous decision to make, to put the child into a locked detention facility. And if we have other services that we can deliver that services to that child, and many of these kids are not in there because of a violent offense, but if there are other ways that we can deliver services in the community, we try and do that first, obviously working with law enforcement. And another change, which is that we do not do Title 47 holds anymore. Title 47 holds are typical case, and that is the trooper picks up the underage youth for drinking 2 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday. We know the child's not going to get charged by a prosecutor for underage consumption, not in every case. I mean, there's some prosecutorial discretion, but previously the trooper would take that child to the youth facility. The child would put into the youth facility, stay there for a day or two, and then be released out to the family. And there was never a charge filed against the child. Federal law now requires that you cannot place that child for these status offenses into a detention facility unless they're charged. And so that's a tremendous policy change that came into effect a while ago, but a little over a year ago. But the result of that is that we've now worked in communities to find other placements. Some of these are in hospitals. Some of them are in other clinics or other places. But it's been successful transitioning off of that. It was a mandate from the federal government. We did that. But that, in conjunction with our detention assessment instrument, which you'll see right now in this chart here, is that we've been successful in actually reducing our average daily population in our facilities, and we've gone from what used to be chronic overcrowding to actually having empty space in some of our facilities. This is a success story, and what we've told our workers and what Director Patty Ware, who's the head of this agency, has been focusing on is, and what this administration has supported is, it's not how do you use less beds in your detention facility so we can save money. It's about how do we invest those dollars and reinvest those savings as we move away from having more of our kids into detention and moving more of our kids into outpatient services. How do we invest those savings into the system to build up those support services so we don't have to end up back in that situation like we were a couple years ago? So we've moved forward on what we call a reinvestment plan. It was a first in our budget in 2005. It's also in this budget, where we continue to project savings based on the great work we've been doing in the last year and a half to move away from using detention first and find other ways to serve kids, least restrictive settings. How do we invest those savings to build up those support services so they're actually getting a better outcome as well? The kids are being rehabilitated. And this is just a great success story. We're actually seeing less bed utilization. In fact, one of the successes is we have a number of cottages. If you've been to our McLaughlin Youth Facility, it has cottages inside the wire. And one of the cottages we've actually taken offline, and that's now being used for other purposes, including providing some a setting where they can use some support services for kids who've transitioned out of the facility. So this, again, is another success story. What we have also implemented is something called the Youth Level of Service Case Management Inventory, and this is a data system which really looks at a lot of scientific evidence around what are those risk factors, what are those different things about a child's situation or their life that makes them exponentially more likely to offend and to commit a violent offense. And there's actually predictors that you can use based on housing, family situations, various things, and previous offenses that you can make pretty rational decision-making about what's the risk. And so we're now using this data system as well. You know, first it was piloted, and now it's being spread statewide as a way in which, as we transition kids out, that we can more correctly tailor the services around those kids that we think are more likely to come back into the system. As we all know, there are a lot of kids that make a stupid mistake once. You know, they're not necessarily bad kids, but they did something stupid, and they end up in our system. They're a whole lot different than that kid who comes in perhaps with the same family background, may even have many similarities to this other kid who's going to be back and forth a lot into the system making more serious offenses. And how do we differentiate between those two kids? Because we're about rehabilitation as well, and we need to invest those resources more smartly. Another agency we have is the Division of Public Assistance. Public Assistance is sort of the more traditional social service agency inside our department. We're providing cash, food, medical, energy assistance benefits under a program called LIHEAP, or Low Income Energy Assistance Program. And we also have really targeted all these programs around promoting self-sufficiency, one of those three tenets I talked about at the very beginning. Many of our individuals who receive services through the Division of Public Assistance receive those seasonally. We have a number of people who have seasonal jobs, and so they may receive their services in the wintertime, receive cash assistance during the wintertime, but then during the summertime they're employed. So we do see a tremendous seasonality, and that's where you'll see a lot of bumps in this chart. Those are largely because of the seasonality of our caseload. But we are providing services to about 40,000 households, and that's for a variety of programs, including food stamps, which is a federal program. It's federal monies, but we administer it for the federal government. I didn't have that as part of our presentation today, but we have a really good story around, well, it was a bad story, but now it's a good story around our food stamp program. One of the things we do is we are required as the minister of this federal program to calculate our error rate our error rate is our overpayments or underpayments. when we came in, our error rate had actually crested over 20%. Was our error rate when the national average is about 7%, 6 or 7%. And this is like the SINAR program. You have to pay a penalty, and it was going to be a big penalty. We actually called it the Save Our Bacon campaign, to be a little cute. Tony Lombardo, who's one of our deputy commissioners, was a new hire, came in, was at that time the director of public assistance, led a very aggressive effort to fix that food stamp error rate. A lot of systems change, a lot of working with employees and with managers, bringing in data, IT, to manage and track those error rates, more specifically down to the employee. And we really turned this thing around, and we did so well in that first year that we came in, and the first quarter data came in saying you're at a 20% error rate, that we actually closed out the year being in pretty good territory. And our last quarter, the data came in, and I think we were below 6% was our error rate. And we actually are now going to receive a bonus from the federal government for being the most improved state in the nation just in the last year. So that's something we'll probably talk about it later here, but we're very proud of. But around our caseload, Director Farnham, Kitty Farnham, presented to you last week. Welfare reform has been a great success. This is a big piece of our program operations in the department. And this really is the one that really shows those core principles the best, and that is that we're about promoting the self-sufficiency of Alaskans. It's not about providing benefits. It's about what do we have to do to get this family from a point of crisis or a point of financial difficulty or emotional difficulty to a point where they're being productive. And the real downstream benefit, as you can see, our caseload has been down 58%. We dropped 9% just in the last year alone. A lot of states are starting to plateau now because they said, you know, that first year after welfare reform, it's sort of the cream of the crop. It's the, you know, the best of the best sitting on your welfare rolls. It's very easy to get them off. As you get down deeper and deeper and deeper into those layers of individuals on your welfare rolls, it gets to be more difficult to get them off. They have more and a multitude of problems, substance abuse, mental health, who knows. You sort of flatline. And we're one of the few states in the nation that have not flatlined. We're still pushing down. We dropped another 9% in the last year alone. And this is a good story. It's not that these people are leaving and they're transitioning off into jobs where they're having earnings. That's a good thing. And the downstream benefit of this, the initial one is that we're saving the state a lot of money. $66 million our spending is down in cash assistance benefits. But the real benefit is going to be seen 20 years from now when you see the next generation of families who previously had this cyclical generation after generation after generation reliance upon government assistance programs, who are going to see the change in that. Because for the first time ever, the kids in these families, when you see a case, that's a family. We're at a peak of almost 13,000 families were receiving services from this program, now down to under 6,000 families receiving services. That means that we have about 7,000 families at that point in time, 7,000 families less, and 7,000 families more that are waking up in the morning and the kids are seeing mom and dad go off to work. And the real benefit, the real downstream benefit, is going to be with those kids when they grow up, that they're coming from homes where mom and dad went to work. And that's something that they should be really proud of. A couple other things that you're going to see during the session that I don't need to talk about today, but the governor has a proposal around senior care, enhancing our prescription drug benefits for seniors. Senior care is administered on the enrollment side by the Division of Public Assistance. And we also have a proposal called basic grants. And this is one of the governor's proposals to make sure that we're putting a small amount of seed money out to communities to build up that support that we know that's already out there providing basic services such as our food banks and our shelters. Second to last agency I'm going to touch upon very quickly, since you've already heard from Dr. Monsager, is public health. He gave a very good overview. I don't need to go through it, but public health deals with vital statistics, our state medical examiner's office, nursing, epidemiology, our labs. There's going to be an issue this session around our replacement of our virology lab back in Fairbanks. We've got a very substantive piece of legislation that's going to be introduced by the governor that we've been pursuing about updating our public health laws in this state. As this chart shows, we're the only state in the nation that doesn't have quarantine authority. And believe me, that's an important thing to know when you have a bioterrorism attack. It's an important thing to know when you have cruise ships coming in. It's an important thing to know when you have cargo planes landing in Anchorage coming from Southeast Asia. As we start to look at the true risk of moving perhaps to a new pandemic around avian flu, these are real challenges out there. And so we want to work constructively with you this year to address this gap in our public health law system. Small little story about public health. We also deal with things like injury prevention. And you can travel right now to over 150 communities in the state, and you'll see at near public uh, parks, largely around lakes, some of our waterfront areas, you'll see free life preservers that are out. And it's called our Kids Don't Float campaign. And these are donated life preservers that we've been able to facilitate this project where I think right now we have over 400 loaner stations in this state where you show up with your watercraft and you're getting ready to leave, and there are flotation devices there for kids that you just borrow them and put them back when you're done. And it's been a great success in preventing drownings of youth in the state. We also have a proposal around breast and cervical cancer that the governor has put forward in his budget. This is just something to have on the horizon this session, particularly those of you who may serve on the budget subcommittee. Because of some declining federal funds, what you'll see in the blue is the federal support for a breast and cervical cancer program we do in our department. We do a screening program in collaboration with the Centers of Disease Control from Atlanta in actually diagnosing women with breast and cervical cancer. And then we provide Medicaid coverage to those women who are deemed to actually have breast or cervical cancer. Because of a shortfall in federal funding, we're looking towards a dip in the number of free screenings that we're going to be able to deliver to low-income women. But we're going to fix that. One of the governor's proposals for FY 2006 is a funding package for our breast and cervical cancer program to invest in this preventative service for women in this state. And we'll certainly work with you constructively and hopefully get your support for this. But as you can see in sort of the, I don't know if it's burgundy, purple, or maroon, I can't see from this angle, but we plan on expanding and actually serving another 3,000 women with that program. And the last agency, very quickly, is Senior and Disability Services. This is an integrated agency that delivers services to seniors and to individuals with disabilities. Some people question, why do you put them together? Well, I think they're a natural fit. They receive the same services, not always from the same provider, not always in the same setting, but they receive long-term care, assisted living, home and community-based waivers. And so we've looked at ways we can more efficiently administer those services. But some of the challenges we have that we'll need to discuss in this upcoming session is this rapid growth of this personal care attendant program. How can we make sure this program is sustainable and it continues to ensure that we're not rushing seniors into institutions? Our goal as an administration, I know many legislators share it, is that we believe seniors should be able to receive their services as close to home, ideally in their home, for as long as possible. But there's a lot of policy that goes along with that and a lot of expense. And so we need to have a good, strong discussion around that this session. We're working on a long-term care study that we'd be happy to update you on individually. And just some basic numbers is that we've got about 3,400 individuals we're serving in the state right now in our personal care attendant program. We have about 3,200 Alaskans that we're serving in more than 100 communities on our home and community-based waiver. And we have about 2,200 folks that we're serving right now in our DD grant program. So it's a large number of folks that we're providing services to, and that's one of the reasons why we've seen this division in particular drive a lot of those Medicaid costs. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to yield and to any questions or whatever you want.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What about alcoholism? Mm-hmm. Big issue in this state. We have lots of fetal alcohol-affected kids. Are there any programs specifically focused on addressing alcoholism prevention, treatment?
We have a large number of programs responding to the chair. We run through the Division of Behavioral Health, this integrated agency. Knowing that I already was probably taking up all your time, try to stick to just one larger issue, this integration. But a key piece of that is substance abuse. One of the governor's proposals for FY 2006 that I'm really proud of the governor for putting in the budget is an increment request of $6 million to strengthen our substance abuse programs. These are all for prevention. We have to target your dollars at the front end. There may be a couple bumpy years, but we have to really work constructively to invest in prevention and turn the tide on substance abuse. Right now, we're looking in the state of Alaska's substance abuse causing about $600 million in economic damage. That's lost productivity, that's correction system, that's detention, that's treatment. That's a lot of money, $600 million going towards substance abuse in this state. And those economic damages are real and they're great. What we are proposing in the governor's budget is to increase our prevention effort by $6 million, looking at national studies, empirical data. What we've seen is that for every dollar you invest in prevention, you save about $10 downstream. So this is a good investment strategy for the state as well. We also operate an office on fetal alcohol syndrome within the department in this agency. We are about ready to see the expiration of a federal grant So a portion of the governor's funding request for substance abuse is the $6 million for new prevention programs, a true expansion, and also $1.1 million to replace lost federal monies and to enhance our fetal alcohol syndrome program. We're still having a large number of babies being born, well over 100 babies being born each year with fetal alcohol syndrome. And it's 100% preventable. One of the frustrations I have, and a number of us who deal with healthcare on a daily basis, is you look at NIH, and we've got the National Institutes on Health, and you've got this great research that's going on a daily basis, trying to find ways to cure things which people didn't bring upon themselves. When I worked in Washington, I worked in the United States Senate for a few years, and we began an effort to double the budget of NIH. At that time, it was about $15 billion, and it's now up to $30 billion, but to double that budget in 5 years. And Congress lived up to its word and got it done. And when you think about it as a nation investing $30 billion a year through NIH and research, and you know you've got this issue here, fetal alcohol syndrome, which doesn't cost a dollar to solve. It's one of those disorders, and of course you look at the actual permanent physical damage that's done to a developing mind, organic injuries that go towards the developing mind of a fetal alcohol syndrome a child victim. It's really shocking to think at this day and age when we know we have something that, quite honestly, we don't have to invent a pill for, we don't have to invest billions of dollars to try and find a cure for, we just have to stop drinking when we're pregnant. That's something, that's a message that needs to be carried consistently and strongly throughout the state. The governor's taken a strong interest in this subject matter. He's obviously put forward a funding request to help support us in our effort. But he also, I know when he met with some of the disabilities groups in the Key campaign last year, he met with a young woman who's a victim of fetal alcohol syndrome. I shouldn't say victim, because she's certainly a trooper, and she's as active as you can get, and she's moving on with her life, but she is also very clear to say that she'll never forgive her mother, and it was a very passionate thing. But she really impressed the governor, and even did a number of PSAs taped with the governor last year, and she's been a very active spokesperson on this issue. So we've got good stories out there, good success stories, but ultimately we're not going to be truly successful until we turn the tide on this. And what we've been investing our dollars in is diagnosis, building up teams to go and diagnose children who are affected by fetal alcohol syndrome, but also to engage in strong community-based, locally controlled, and developed intervention campaigns. And we know, looking at the data, too, you learn a lot from data. We've learned over the years, really digging into the data, is that there are predictors to determine who are the women who are going to have children, who are going to drink during pregnancy and are going to have fetal alcohol syndrome babies. We know that if you look at women who are sexually assaulted under the age of 18, exponentially more likely to be a mother who's going to give birth to a fetal alcohol syndrome or fetal alcohol effect baby. And so how do we use that data, that good data we've collected over the last few years, through the support of Senator Stevens, who's really helped build up this program in the legislature, how do we use that data to start developing targeted interventions towards some priority populations that we think are more likely to be those that contribute to the prevalence of fetal alcohol syndrome in the state? So a lot of work to do, but I think we've got a good proposal to start the conversation this session.
You know, it's really very heartwarming for me to see the change that's starting to take place from just throwing money at the problem and a slow change to really looking at prevention, because that's going to make a huge difference in the long run. So I'm very pleased to hear that.
I'm sure you don't have any time for this. I know we've gone on pretty long today, but people often ask the questions, if you can reflect back upon that Medicaid chart where you see the $1 billion that we're spending, and it's not a request to put the chart up, Sherry, but we're spending $1 billion and we have these large number of enrollment, and everyone's asking, well, what are you going to do? How are you going to stem the tide of this cost? Well, the simple and easy way is you just cut the program. You know, you just serve less people. But we have to also move beyond that dialogue and look at how do we deliver services in a way in which we improve health outcomes. A healthier Alaska and a healthier population doesn't require services as much. And a number of us in the department and some outside the department, we had a participation from the legislature, Senator Dyson and his staff, and some members from the municipality of Anchorage's health department joined us, and we went to New Orleans at the end of November last year and participated in a National Governors Association sponsored event to look at chronic disease management. And we had already done a lot of work in the department around looking at these chronic disease issues, many of them that were mentioned in Dr. Monsager's presentation last week. But you look at the tremendous burden being placed upon our healthcare system by acute episodic interactions with our healthcare system that are driven by chronic conditions, asthma, heart disease, obesity. We know that that we don't have to be seeing people in such an expensive way, where you leave the doctor's office, you have this flare-up for this chronic condition you have, and so you end right back into the doctor's office, into the operating room, or in the emergency room. It's very expensive to interact with people with chronic conditions through episodic acute care interactions. How do we transition our healthcare system and the way we deliver our healthcare system? How do we transition the way we deliver medicine itself, the way we pay for it, the way we design our system around it, to move away from that type of interaction to one where we do case management, to the way we almost reform the way the clinician delivers services, so that it's not about how many people do you serve in the operating room, it's about how many nurses do you have at the front desk in your doctor's office who are calling the patient to say, are you taking your medication, are you going on walks today? It's that quality improvement in outcomes and tackling the chronic disease burden in our system that's ultimately going to allow us to flatline the growth projections on expenditures. But that's tremendous system change. And it's not just the state. We're a payer. It's about individual practitioners, doctors themselves. There was a cardiologist at the event who mentioned how you can leave medical school as a trained cardiologist, and basically you can work directly from the operating room. You know, you can have someone who answers your messages and have a small office, but really you basically do your work from the operating room. And our reimbursement system encourages that. How many stents and how many angioplasties can you do? But rather, perhaps we should have our reimbursements system designed in a way in which it's still attractive for a physician or a cardiologist who comes out to work from their office and find ways that they can interact with people who have high blood pressure or heart disease or other chronic conditions to manage that disease burden and make sure that you can keep them out of the operating room. And that's a challenge that I think we as providers and we as payers are going to have to engage in some sustained dialogue around. And that National Governors Association event was a good start in that conversation.
Sounds wonderful. Great. Any other members have a question? Representative Seaton?
Sure. We talked a little about senior care, and mm-hmm. I know there's a senior dental care model. I bring this up because in Homer, I've just been supporting the Soldovia Native Health Community Health Center expansion into dental. And the reason for that, there's plenty of dentists there, but no one will take any more Medicaid patients. There's a few that are taking, you know, Denali Kid Care and Medicaid, but they're not taking any new patients. And are you experiencing that same thing across the state? And what's going to happen if we create a new program, Medicaid-based for seniors, and nobody'll see them under the program? Is there any?
It's a very real concern in response to the chair, and it's one that was discussed a lot in my office as we planned this. We do have a problem in this state about being able to move from the insurance coverage itself to the actual delivery of services in a chair, in a dental chair in this state. Right now, Medicaid currently covers for adults only emergency dental services. Basically, when the tooth has to be pulled, we'll cover. When you show up at the ER, we'll cover your dental services. So the governor's proposal and what will be introduced to the legislature as part of a senior care package, as Representative Seaton mentioned, is a proposal to expand our Medicaid dental services in a way in which we cover preventative services, not just these acute, high-cost pull and extracts. We developed this proposal in conjunction with the Mental Health Trust Authority, who are contributing a portion of the funding to provide the match dollars for this Medicaid expansion, because it does cost a modest, but it does cost some money. And we had lengthy conversations about how are we going to make sure that when we cover these seniors, or we cover these adults, because they're not all seniors, when we cover these adults, that they're going to be able to get into a chair. We've had some dialogue with the dental community. Had a meeting in my office with the dental community as a casual initial conversation with the Dental Association. There are a number of concerns that they raise with why they don't accept Medicaid beneficiaries, ranging from the rate to the provider agreement and everything in between. And I don't say that in a derogatory sense. It just means there's a myriad of reasons. You can't just say one dentist doesn't accept Medicaid for this one reason. You have some dentists who are not satisfied with the rate. You have some dentists who already have a full practice and don't have additional space in their practice. You have some dentists who don't like the provider agreement that Medicaid providers have to sign to enroll as a Medicaid provider. So there's a collection of various reasons, and we've been trying to have dialogue with the dental community to knock those off one by one. But we still have dental shortage areas. Senator Stevens has been a tremendous advocate and ally with our department in trying to make sure we have dental access in this state. But it's not a problem that's going to go away just because we have coverage. And I think it's a legitimate point, and it's one that we're still working on. What we do know is that there is some chair capacity. We can get seniors in to see that. It's something that the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education, that they'll be testifying in support of. It's a need to get them insured. I think we're slowly knocking down those barriers with the dental community. There's obviously been more high-profile discussions we don't need to get into about the Native community themselves and them trying to build some capacity in terms of dental services. It's a challenge. It's a tremendous challenge. And one thing we don't want to do is offset the number of chairs in operation by saying, well, there's a finite number of seats today, and we go from having, you know, these kids having coverage, now kids and adults, and now we have kids who are not getting services because an adult got in that chair. I don't really have a quick answer for you today, as you can probably tell. But what we're going to focus on is working provider by provider, and we have a dental officer for the state of Alaska, and he's working on a daily basis with the providers individually to try and get more of them to enroll in Medicaid. I think we're still going to have access problems at the end of the day, but many will be served.
Commissioner, I've heard several comments that one of the reasons, and this might be one of many, mm-hmm. was that many times they had appointments and the people never showed mm-hmm. up, and so mm-hmm. then therefore they hear that dentist has made set mm-hmm. aside time, but if just on a whim something else came up and they don't bother to show up because they don't have to pay for it anyway, so kind of we want to respond to that.
That's another reason I've heard from dentists as well. I've heard some have a certain type of clientele and ours don't fit it. The patients don't show up on time, don't miss appointments, our rate's not high enough, that the provider agreement we don't want to enter into with the state of Alaska, we want waiver on any audits, we don't want to be held liable for any type of fraud and abuse accusation ever. It's a litany of things, and I think it's each provider has their own reasons, and so we have to work with them individually. We have done a better job working with our fiscal agent on ensuring that our beneficiaries show up on time, some affirmative efforts to make sure we can get them to show up for their appointments. You don't have to convince me that a no-show is a burden to a practice. I think these are all barriers we can work through. For example, the provider agreement that the dentist would have to sign is the same provider agreement that any Medicaid provider, it's not a unique one for dentists, and every other provider specialty signs the form, and it's not that big a deal. But for the dentist, it's a challenge. And so we have to accept that at face value and say, for this group of providers, this is a problem, and work with them constructively to find solutions so that we can make sure those chairs open up.
I'm glad to hear that you are on top of it and trying to do something about it, so mm-hmm. we appreciate that. Any other questions? Representative Coring?
I've been sitting here for the last hour and a half hearing all the wonderful benefits of all these programs. You referred to as a myriad of programs that the state is providing, and I'm concerned about that, quite frankly. I'm concerned that maybe we're moving in the direction of providing too much, that we're creating a society in this state of greater dependence than what we should. And I would prefer to see a less of an emphasis on measuring our success based on how much money we can spend on programs providing services across the board for so many Alaskans, you'd mentioned about 100,000 people, and look more at maybe focusing on those that truly need the help. For example, our senior citizens that are low income or somebody that's disabled and just can't fend for themselves. So I'm just making a general statement that I would like to see a greater emphasis or at least a demonstration to the legislature, maybe through the budget subcommittee process that I assume Representative Hawker is going to chair again for Hess, on ways that we can be more efficient with Hess and ways that we can deliver programs with less money, and maybe ways that we can figure out how to get less people off the rolls. You demonstrated one example of how there's less on the welfare rolls, and that's great, but when I hear numbers like 100,000 people being served, 40,000 households, 26,000 people on WIC, those numbers to me sound quite astounding, quite frankly, and maybe you can take that as a respectful request to figure out how you can demonstrate to the legislature that that you are serving those that truly need it, and it's not just a wide myriad of programs that is providing basically birth to death programs for as many Alaskans as we can squeeze in.
Well, responding to the chair, Representative, first and foremost, we do not use as performance measures, at least to the best of my knowledge. I don't know of a single one. We don't have a single performance measure that's based on how much we spend. That is something we are adamantly opposed to. We would not support. We don't do it. We focus on the services we're delivering, whether or not we're giving a benefit to society for those services. Eligibility, as you mentioned, eligibility, such as Medicaid eligibility, that's defined by statute. And those are decisions that this legislature has made over a number of years. We implement those changes, and that statute that's been passed by this legislature, not this session, but by previous legislators, and they're entitlement programs, and we have to administer those. We don't control that eligibility. I join you in saying that our caseloads are incredibly high. Our Medicaid rolls are exceedingly high. You know, we're approaching a point where we almost have 23% of our state's population on Medicaid. That's not sustainable. I think we all know that's not sustainable, and that's not what we believe in. And that's why I started my presentation by saying that we in the department, working with where we have flexibility, we are targeting all of our resources to how we can promote self-sufficiency and move people off our programs. That's what we're committed to. We've worked constructively with our subcommittee chair, Representative Hawker, over the last two legislatures, and we'll be doing it again this session as well, to find ways in which we can reduce the costs of our programs to the residents of this state. Over our first two fiscal years, actually including this fiscal year submission by the governor, we've reduced general fund expenditures by 100. Total expenditures. Is it total expenditure or general fund? We've reduced general fund expenditures in our department by $160 million. We've made our programs $160 million more affordable to Alaskans since I took over as commissioner. And while I share your concern about the high number of individuals who are receiving services from the state, in fact, you're not going to find a greater ally in finding ways in which we can make our programs more responsive to the actual needs of the consumers and at the same time put a greater burden upon the individuals to make sure they are providing for themselves. Ultimately, there are some areas where we don't have flexibility. It's a statute we implement. But what we are going to continue to do in all of our programs is make sure that they are tailored towards self-sufficiency. That's why we showed you that we're trying to get people off the rolls, back to work. We have to deliver our services more efficiently. Integrating services, wrapping those services around the consumer makes them more efficient. We don't performance measure around how much we spend. And I think we've had real progress for those who served on our subcommittee and also working with Representative Hawker very collaboratively over the last couple sessions to try to find ways that we can lower those costs. Case management, bringing in case management, trying to find ways in which we did, in some cases, cap services, limit services, but we've reduced general fund expenditure by $160 million. Our general fund request for fiscal year 2005 was actually below 2004, which I can only tell you is our sign that we're committed with you to find ways that we can make these programs more affordable and that we can lower the costs. Ultimately, I have to accomplish the mission of the department, and that mission is healthy and safe communities. There are some programs the legislature has created, and we implement those programs. They're not without problems. And I'd like to work with you constructively this session to try and address those and make sure that we are providing the level of service that's needed by the population and that which our Constitution supports.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate you coming by today. And look forward to, I know we'll be seeing you a lot more as session progresses, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just want to let everybody know that there will not be a HESS meeting this Thursday. And we will be having one the next Tuesday, however. And Representative Seaton, you had a question?
Madam Chair, I noticed there are some handouts. Do you have something for us? We didn't get it up here. Or are you going to save that for a later presentation?
They were being printed when I came over, so I'm not sure if they arrived.
We did get some that arrived. I'm not sure they're enough for everybody. But
they're coming.
Yeah. Okay.
We actually have some here. We could, and for the committee, this is actually an executive summary of our budget overview, but it contains a lot of the same information that the commissioner relays. So I'm happy to distribute.
Yeah, if we can at least to the members of the committee, that'd be great.
I think we have more.
On the way.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And aside from that, I guess then this committee is adjourned. Thank you.